All right, tonight we have Agave Spirits and Tequila Royalty. We're going to get to talk to the man, the legend, Jake Lustig, the guy that not only could bring some of the best distilleries together into one brand, Art de Nam, but also brings us this amazing mezcal brand that we're going to learn about and talk about today. So stick around. This is going to be a great interview. It's Tasting Tequila. Okay, I am fired up to be here with what I called in my intro video some agave spirit tequila royalty. Jake Lustig, how are you doing today, my friend?
Great, Brad. Thank you. Thanks for having me. Excited to talk about some mezcal here today and drink some as well.
Yeah, I have the Tobala in a glass already. Tell me what you're going to pour there.
The ensemble, I'm drinking my Arroquino, kind of a personal favorite of the species. Of the varietals. But cheers to you. Thanks for coming.
Cheers to you, my friend.
Salud. Feliz viernes.
This is so good.
Yeah,
okay. There we go. So for the people that haven't met you or the people that haven't heard one of your interviews, tell a little bit about, who is Jake Lustig? How did your tequila journey and mezcal journey start?
Oh, okay. I was going to start that like the jerk. I was born a poor black child. I've only realized in more recent history that my story is so backwards from what I typically hear other guys and people talking about. I'm born in San Francisco and raised in the Bay Area. My mother remarried and moved to Southern Mexico when I was a kid and bounced back and forth. She didn't stay in Southern Mexico, but would take me down there. Later, she bought a house down there and then moved down and remarried. My father mostly raised me in the Bay. And in my late teen years, I drove a pickup truck down there and was wanting to learn more about Oaxaca and more know her better, frankly, make those kind of connections that I missed. And she ended up selling the house and moving away. And I was there with my pickup truck, and this was the very late 80s, maybe 1990, 91, right in that era. And I had a good buddy of mine, still one of my best friends, David Sanchez, who he and I would take tourists out to pottery villages and wood carving villages and rug weaving villages. And one day we had a couple who wanted to, we only could take as many people as we could fit in the bench seat and one in the back of this pickup truck. And we had a couple that wanted to go see a distillery. And I called my stepdad to remember, where was that distillery you took me when I was younger? And he told me I went there and they got inebriated that day, the pair that we had taken out there, and gave me a $300 tip. I've told this story so many times now. And I realized, wow, this is interesting. This is what I want to do. This is lucrative. And David continued on with the artisan village tours, and I just focused on that. And I knew nothing about it. I would just translate for people their questions. And I ended up figuring I could do a graduate college with an undergraduate thesis on kind of mapping out the distilleries of Southern Mexico. And it was a really wonderful professorial, wonderful man, Alberto Sanchez Lopez, from the National Council of Science and Technology, El Consejo Nacional de Ciencia y Tecnología, which was a federal funded organization that researched forestry and fisheries and computer sciences, minerals, all kinds of that kind of stuff. And he was, and still is, a real mezcal aficionado, and would lend me his time and his kind of schooling on, and he was also connected with the WAPO, the Universidad Autónoma de Benito Juárez, which is the national university system, which would accredit my work so that UC California, University of California, Santa Cruz, would accept my papers. And after about a year, I had figured out about 80 to 86, 87, 88 distilleries and different zones and different methods of production, and then was hired and then fired, but to create the kind of foundations of a brand for somebody. And that person wanted me to source different mezcals and mix them all together so he could establish a less varied flavor, a more stable flavor, mm-hmm. not so dependent on weather or, you know, lot to lot variations. And the best producers that I had found would not mix their mezcal with anyone else's, of course. And when I was then summarily fired later, after about a year and a half, my lady already had a bulge in her belly. That's a son who's now 31. And I decided to do a brand, but I had no money. So I had to learn how to write a business plan and shop a business plan around 51 people turned me down. Nearly 20 of them accepted little sample bottles, had follow-up meetings with me. And finally, proverbially as it goes, you know, just at the very end when I was just, as we say in Yiddish, vermished, I didn't have no way, what am I gonna, how am I go from here? Desesperado in Spanish. A guy with a ranch in Michoacan and some restaurants in Northern California and all kinds of different businesses took a real interest in it and said, hey, I'll invest, I'll partner up with you. And I went to my very favorite of the distilleries and said, why don't we renovate this old funky distillery in need of even like new corrugated tin roofing. I mean, it was really new ollas, because the ollas crack, the ceramic pots, when you heat and cool and heat and cool, they crack. New refractoria, which are the bricks that can handle high heat, more expensive. And so we renovated the distillery. That was in 1994, and produced our first batches together in 1995. And I just really fell in love with it. And I was, you know, young and inexperienced. I didn't maybe have some of the reverence of old ways. I saw things through more of a critical lens. I couldn't understand why all these old guys would suffer rheumatoidal arthritis by smashing with a mazo and what they call a mazo y canoa, a dugout tree trunk, a canoe, smashing agave. It's like coming from the United States. We wouldn't expect anyone to use a jackhammer on the streets without, you know, shock absorbers. This trozador, which is the thing that shreds agave, that existed in Oaxaca. To build that, I ended up going to old lumber sites and buying exhausted 22-inch steel chainsaw blades, or the bars, excuse me, where they want to retire them before the chain starts regularly jumping off the track. And we had guys cut those down and put edges on them and weld them onto spindles, try different horsepower motors, and kind of recreating in my mind's eye the standard municipal tree shredder, you know, tree mm-hmm. chipper, branch chipper that we have in Northern, up here in the United States. So I did different things like that. I was accused of industrializing mezcal at different points. My vindication on that was when the Mezcal Regulatory Council, but then called the Comercom, delivered updates of that same destrozador, that same chipper, to 72 different villages.
Wow.
You know, so I saw that we were burning so many trees. And when I was young, I worked on tree replanting projects in Northern California after big lumber mills would do clear cuts. They'd pay us 26 cents a tree to replant hillsides. And I had that mentality. So I'd gotten to know by that point Carlos Camarena at La Alteña in Tequila, in Arandas, and brought my master distiller, my partner, and our engineer and an architect to copy the Alteña oven, which Felipe Camarena and his dad had, and I should say their dad had built. And we put the first one of those steam ovens in Oaxaca, which later we stopped using. We only use it now for Mino Real, another mezcal that we make, more of a cocktail style mezcal. But just trying to play around with production, innovate, fall back, respect traditions, then work on how to noodle through them with some innovation that was very welcome. Some wasn't so welcome, but we're still at it 32 years later. Last year, Don Amado Rustico won in one of the big tasting reviews, best of class artisanal mezcal in the United States. We regularly win double golds and all that. It sells well in Mexico, sell around the world now.
Wow.
So your story kind of started in mezcal, and then you graduated over into the tequila world, brought a tequila brand to the world, and then went back to mezcal before creating Arte de Nam. Is that correct?
Yeah, as it happens to be, it was correct. One of the guys who really liked my mezcal in Mexico was Don Raul Plasencia, who wanted to build a distillery in 1998 called Espolón Tequila. And he saw that I had already been exporting mezcal and that I had figured out some of the legalities and methods of doing that. And then I knew a little bit about routes to market. And the company that imported the brand right off the bat was Haas Brothers out of San Francisco, who picked that brand up. They've been making bourbon since 1872. And they had been in the vodka business. They were the original importers for the west of Stolichnaya, for example. Interesting background. But they wanted to do a tequila. And on the agreement that I would work for them to launch Espolón, I got involved with that and then really learned about the big league U.S. distribution channels. That one in particular was Southern Wine and Spirits. And with that first kid and then a second one, I was very eager for, a first and 15th paycheck, or I should say 15th and 31st paycheck and health insurance. So I went to work for Southern Wine and Spirits and was remarked, tasked with developing the tequila portfolio and other Latin-oriented brands, was remarked about how little anybody understood what was behind what they were selling. And at that time, I think still currently, a lot of tequila brands were just jumping producers based on kind of like pricing, not really understanding that tequila is a very different type of spirit. Agave spirits generally are very site-specific, very terroir-driven. It's like in table wine, you can't move a Pinot Noir from California Central Coast to California Sierra Foothills and pretend like nothing's changed. All your consumers are going to notice. But that was happening a lot with tequila. And in mezcal, kind of going back to what I was saying at the beginning of the conversation, everything, you go into a restaurant or a bar, and you sit down and you say, what would you like to drink? You say, what is the mezcal de la casa? That's the house mezcal. Then there's always, inevitably, we have el mezcal de la casa, which usually came from the municipality of Tlacalula or Santiago Matetan, which sits along the Pan-American Highway, big trucking route, which becomes our Highway 5 in California up through Oregon and Washington. It starts all the way in Tierra del Fuego and goes all the way to Alaska. But as it meanders through Oaxaca, there'd be a lot of, subjectively, I'll say, lower grade mezcal available for kind of tourists and people on that trucking route. But there'd be, they call Oaxaca Los Valles Centrales. There's three valleys. It's kind of like a Mercedes insignia where one goes up to Mexico City and one goes that Pan American Highway down to the Isthmus. And then another one would go southwesterly into the Sierra Pacifico Hill mountains. And kind of 9 hours later, if you could pop out on the other end, you would, down by Pachutla and Puerto Escondido. But there was no trucking through there. But that third valley had mines, M-I-N-E-S, like nickel and silver, not too much gold mines. But they retained a lot of old, like, adhesion to old styles and traditions with less intrusion and invasion, I guess, from outside people and ideas and traffic. So in that valley, which at the back end, there's the town Miahuatlán, but the other town's like Sola de Vega. The towns like that Vago does a great job working in. Ejutla is another one. But our town, Santa Catarina Minas, St. Catherine's mine there. And so that style of mezcal made in ollas de barro, made in ceramic pots, mm-hmm. was known as minero. So you'd have this mezcal de la casa from Santiago, Matutlan, or Tlacalula, that was kind of a cheaper, shoddier mezcal. Then you'd have minero, which was the really boutique mezcal. And then a third called refinado, which does not sound very good, refinado, to the gringo ear. But refinado meant refined, and that was okay. Barrel-aged, because there'd been Mexico is a land that was occupied by the Spanish and the French for 400 years, and the French for 40 months or something like that. But they left behind an interest in brandy and a lot of brandy barrels. And some of those brandy barrels would make their way into mezcal. So those were your options. And then you'd say, this one's from Santa Catarina Minas or Sola de Vega. The next question anyone asks is, who's the family? Oh, this is made by the Quiros, or this is the Arrianes, or this is the, you know. And by knowing the region and the family, you can navigate just like a wine geek does, you know, with what they're excited to drink that night. And then in tequila, there was just like none of that conversation. One of the first things I did was write the Latin market sales manual, which gave a couple of paragraphs of explanation about every single freaking thing that Southern Wine and Spirits sold, that had any validity at all in Latin culture and why. So that salespeople, before they could walk into the store or the restaurant to pitch the brand, could know a little something about it. And Southern put up with my antics for 11 years while I kept feeding them brands. I kind of had my hand in a couple different cookie jars, but I would feed them brands and then sell everything, serve all the masters. But that was the inspiration to do Artenón, was kind of a tequila that would bring all of that inherently into it, in the same way that we in Oaxaca look at a mezcal.
You know, I think Artenón does such a great job of explaining to people what a nom is, what a distillery is, what flavor tastes like, how tequila can differ. Like the picture that you painted and what you wanted to produce actually does it. Like, I'll hear bartenders talking about, you know, this 1579, and they'll relate back to G4, and they'll talk about, you know, how it's made. And then you'll see them bring out, you know, the 1123 and talk about how it's different and how it relates back to mezcal. And I love hearing when people who know about it talk about it. And then, of course, I'm the nerd that stops somebody in Total Wine and explains the whole process.
Bravo.
I love it.
Bravo.
I think it's amazing.
But yeah, I mean, that culture, which has been ported into tequila a little bit, is the foundation of mezcal. And you know, I always think of my good friend Esteban Morales about the raicillas, you know, venenosa and those. Very much the same kind of thing, you know, of region, producer, methodology. I import now, with my team imports the mezcal de Emilio Veira of Don Mateo from Michoacán. And I'm just so thrilled with those mezcals. And they're so totally distinct from what we do in Oaxaca. And they used yet another, you know, style of distillation, other species of agave. We don't even have the cupriata in Oaxaca, and that's primarily what they use in Michoacán.
Is there is rhodocantia in Oaxaca? Okay. I see a lot of raicillas are rhodocantia, or I think it's also, is it Maximilian? Is that the other name?
You know, Brad, the thing is, I tell you, I only know the very limited amount of actually what I know. I mean, I knew early on, I applied myself to learning the regions of Oaxaca, of course, not all of them, but many regions of Oaxaca, and mezcal styles from there, and whether they sold Zapoteco or Mixteco, or whether Mixe, you know, Chontal, like the different language groups, because that was sometimes very difficult to even find someone in some of those towns who would speak Spanish. It's pretty remarkable to think. And I learned a lot about regional politics, you know, go kiss the ring of the local caudillo, the guy who's got everything on lockdown before you start sniffing around.
Right.
And then I learned about different ways that people distilled mezcal, but I never had much of an interest in botany other than some pursuits as a teenager in the mountains of Northern California.
Sure.
I was really just so in love with the Espadín. And then early on in Don Amado, we'd make Don Amado Espadín, but with 10% Tobalá. And I didn't even realize that what I was doing was hipper than I knew by doing an ensemble. But we used too much of the Tobalá, and there wasn't very much Tobalá left in our valley. And so I got on my soapbox and started worrying about, we were chopping down the last, you know, taking the last orchid lily out of the Amazon, you know, verboten to use wild agave, and just fell in love with the arroqueño because it was cultivatable and just so delicious to me. And then the times caught up with it, and the CRM put nurseries all over the place and made a requirement that if you're going to use silvestre wild agave, they call them silvestres, that you've got to replant two for every one that you take. And so that remedied that problem. But people ask me about all the different types of agave. I just have no idea. I mean, I know the ones we've always used, which are Tobalá, Espadín, Arroqueño. A Karwinski, that's a long one, we just humbly call it Largos.
Mm-hmm.
Long ones.
Long ones, yeah.
The Greek classification of which type of Karwinski. I see you've got a bottle of it there in front of you. That one always has done well in Asian countries. It's very savory.
Okay.
It mixes really well with what we call unami, like savory notes, not so sweet. And then Barril Mexicano, Cuiche.
So I have a question for you. So on the ones that we have here, which one of the agaves are cultivated? Is it just the Arroqueño and
only the Espadín? Arroqueño and Espadín, yeah.
Okay, and then everything else is all wild always, right?
Yeah, there's a Karwinski we use a lot that it just grows like a weed. I mean, it's all over the place. It's, you know, it's at the end of every row. There's clusters of it. Okay. Barril is a lot. Mexicano, there's a lot of them out there.
What's your growth time of Largo, the Arroqueño?
The Largo, those ones, it's around 13 years.
Okay.
11 to 13 years. Our Espadín is 6 years.
Okay.
Arroqueño is 16, 17 years. Sometimes 18 years.
Wow, so it's that long. Wow.
Yeah.
And like, isn't the Tepozate like 25 years sometimes?
23. Yeah, 23 years.
Yeah. That's crazy.
We do Tepozate very sparingly.
That one's usually the most expensive.
Mostly, I'll tell you, over the years, I'm really just about, I mean, I love the varietals we do. I really like right now the Tobalá and the Biquiche. In fact, we doubled the Tobalá in that because I wanted to really drive more sweetness in it, more of that botanical sweetness juxtaposed to the kind of savory, drier herbaceousness of Quiche. But I just really am such a fan of Espadín and then Arroqueño.
Yeah, I just poured the Arroqueño. It's so
good.
Have
you tried the Rústico there?
Yeah, this is the first time I've had this one. And it is.
Which one is that? Arroqueño? Yeah.
Yeah, the Arroqueño. arroqueño. Very fruity, very floral.
Okay, it's like arro and then cane, like a sugar cane. Arroqueño, yeah, yeah.
Yep. I'm working on the Spanish. I'm working diligently
It's the kind of an intimidating word.
And so Salud. Production method on all of these are going to be in the ground, hornos, right? Cooked in the ground.
Correct.
And then you're using a shredder for the maceration and then clay pot distillation for all of them.
Correct. Correct.
And is that wood-fired clay pot?
Outside it's wood and indoors we use natural gas.
Okay. And then I'm assuming, because I don't know, wood fermentation with fibers, all open fermentation?
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And I'm going to assume the time frames of fermentation vary, you know, time frames of the year. Are you doing...
That's it.
Like fibers
when we need
in...
To heat it, when we need to... When it's really cold,
mm-hmm.
What we'll do is heat up our river stones. We keep the same stone because if there's water in them, they can swell and split and be very dangerous. But we'll heat up river stones and put them in our fermentation tanks.
Okay.
To warm up the mash if it gets too cold. Because what we really like to hit is around 4 days.
Okay.
Not exceeding 5 days of fermentation.
So when you do fermentation, this is some of the things I don't know about mezcal versus tequila, and I'm always learning more. So some places I've read of fill the fermentation vats with the fibers, and before they ever add any water, they let it start to ferment before water is added. Is that the way you guys do that too?
Well, first what we do is we actually leave the agave to develop a little bit of a mold on them.
Okay.
For about 3 days when we brought them down to the distillery. And then we shred the agave.
Okay.
And then we put it into the fermentation tanks, the vats, which are like a 6-person hot tub, kind of to imagine, wooden hot tub. To use a very first world gringo reference. So you can see these tanks here in the back.
Yeah.
Those are our standard fermentation tanks.
Okay.
And what you've got, seeing as I can show this picture, you see this olla here? This is a 60-liter clay pot, which is about the maximum length of a Oaxacan potter woman's arm to be able to spin it.
It's all the bigger they get, huh?
And you'll see that there's this water coming in off the creek.
Okay.
That falls into this, like, saucepan-looking metallic... it's almost like an embudo, like a funnel with a conical bottom. That's a caso. And it just runs back, that water runs over that pan and then back down this tube made of carrizo, right? Well, this is still metal, and then it joins a carrizo, like a bamboo, and it goes right back into a trough and back to the creek. That's just to keep that caso, that sartén, it's a like a saucepan kind of thing. Keeping that cold. And then this top pot has no bottom. It's a bottomless pot. And it sits on another pot, which does have a bottom. And so one worker will lift up this pot and with those pitchforks in the background there, put in fermented maguey, as they call the agave there, the mosto, the must. And then they'll replace that top pot and we'll stick little twigs, branches, very low heat as a fire source or now that we do a lot indoors too, gas. And very, very slowly heat up the fermented agave with its fiber in the lower pot. And when that alcohol gets to 176 degrees Fahrenheit, it's already at its boiling temperature. But the water doesn't boil until 212 degrees Fahrenheit. So you have that like approximately 40 degrees where your alcohol is going to be evaporating, but not your water. And so your alcohol, hot air rises. So your hot alcohol vapors rise up and they hit the bottom of that gossle, of that pan with the conical bottom. And because it's cold because of that cold water. Gravity pulls the little droplets of the evaporating alcohol vapor down to the lowest point. And it would just drip down from where it came back into the mash below. Except there's a little wooden spoon suspended by some string right in the middle. And it lands instead on that spoon. And the spoon perforates the side of this top pot into that length of carrizo, of bamboo, and then dribbles down into that receptacle. And then once the distiller realizes that most of the alcohol has been evaporated and doesn't want to dilute it by now evaporating water, we'll stop the whole thing, wait for it to cool down, lift off this top pot, scoop out the exhausted mash below, and replace it and start the whole thing over again. That whole process takes 24 hours to distill one of those 1,000 metric tons, 1,000 kilos of agave in 24 hours. And we'll reduce 1,000 liters down to 76-80 liters.
So tell me if I'm wrong. You just explained the most primitive way of a condenser on a still.
Well, if you go on vacation and you come back and your yogurt or your apple juice in your fridge tastes tangy and you say, God dang it, I forgot. I should have thrown this away. You know, it's fermented. You just throw it away. If you imagine being, you know, locked up serving time and you think ahead, your dear old ma's birthday is 2 months away, and you take your little, if you could get it, a little tin cup and get some apple juice and hide it under your cot and look at it every few days and eagerly wait after, you know, enough time has passed by, 6 weeks or 2 months, maybe you rip up newspaper, whatever you can, you suspend your little tin cup of fermented apple juice. You take a little scrap of the shaving mirror that you might have there and suspend it over the cup at an angle. And as that fermented apple juice gets to 176 degrees, little wisps of vapor going to rise up
right. And
beat up on the mirror. And you'll hold the mirror at an angle and dribble it down in a little thimble shot glass and have a little toast de mâle.
Yeah.
About the simplest way you can explain distillation, I think.
And I know you learned that from watching the movie Shawshank Redemption.
Did they do that in Shawshank?
No, I don't think so, but the way you put it back to waiting on
that's
that special
day. That's
one
of my favorite movies. I'll tell you that.
It's a great movie.
I love it where they're sitting at the end of the movie and see what Neho.
I haven't watched that movie in a while.
When you understand what a primitive distillation, by saying primitive, I don't mean without layers of experience and skill and nuance.
Yeah. But primitive in technique, not primitive in knowledge.
Primitive in technique or technology. Yeah. Technology.
Yeah. So,
and of course, this is called the Filipino still. That we hear about Ponce de Leon and Ferdinand Magellan and those Spanish explorers working. Well, Ponce de Leon, I guess, was on the Caribbean side, but Ferdinand was on the Pacific Rim, and the Spanish fishing armadas would work that rim and pick up these stills, or at least the technology for them, the idea of them, in Southeast Asia, and bring it all the way around, working the coast of Peru and up Mexico. And in southern Mexico, this technology stuck. And of course, it was so clandestine to produce booze because the viceroy of Spain wanted to impose taxes on Spanish brandies and wine. But Oaxaca is just rugged enough. When you look at a map of Mexico, it's broad as like the southern United States, and then it gets very tight, and then it kind of opens back up in the hook. Those are two tectonic plates crashing against each other, juting the land up to 6,000 feet right in the middle. And it's kept those Oaxacan and Jarocho Veracruzanos so isolated that they've been able to endure, you know, 500-600 years of colonialism and still speak 19 indigenous languages.
Yeah, wow.
Not because they didn't want to learn Spanish. They want to resist. And it was kind of the perfect place for them to embrace this type of distillation and stay out of the sight of the law. And it was just so amazing to me that even in the 1980s, just nobody gave two hoots about it.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I remember having Ron Cooper over for dinner in 94 and cooking him food and telling him about this clay pot stuff. And he, you know, he summarily went and looked for it and did a great job adding a minero to his line.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it was just really something people didn't know too much about.
Sure.
But here's a mezcal question, because we've watched tequila go through this real transformation, right? From traditional to incredibly industrial. And then now I'm going to say kind of a switch back to craft and traditional, and people are learning.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I know that there's big corporations in mezcal today. So is there the same thing that we have to look out for when we go to a liquor store or a restaurant and we're going to choose a mezcal? Are there mezcals that are adulterated and not made in these same traditional methods like in tequila?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But they just really have not prospered.
Okay, that's exciting.
A lot of us will remember Signum. Made an attempt at that. They tried to do a diffuser mezcal.
Okay.
And by the end, they couldn't give it away.
Gotcha.
There's a few, out of respect, I won't name them, but they're pretty obvious. But the more common model, if people want to really build up mezcal production, has been maybe like Illegal has done it. Which is lots of small stills.
Okay.
Or Del Maguey has done it through using a lot of producers that they pay a standardized per liter price, and they mix all these different producers. And so it's been kind of how to amalgamate a lot of small into something more than do one operation with high output.
I was going to say, for yours, how easy is it for people to find Don Amato? Is it widely available, or is it smaller batches and harder to find?
I mean, technically, it's available in 46 states and around Mexico and in Europe and Asia, Australia. But, you know, I have a lot of projects. We do a lot of different. Sometimes we say there's only so many, you know, bottles you put in a bag. It's not I wouldn't say it's a driver in my book, but you can go to our website and type in your zip code
and find it that way.
With any luck, find a retailer somewhere within 25 miles. It's something I'm always working on distributors to put out there more. What happens in mezcal, which is, there's a lot of, well, I want to say exploration. You know, people will try a bottle and maybe really, really love it and be so enthused that they want to try a new bottle of something else. And, you know, you don't see too many people. I mean, how many, I can't say. I don't have this qualitatively, but or quantitatively. But it's an emerging category still for, obviously, you know, for a lot of people. And a lot of people come to mezcal from tequila, feeling like tequila might be too standardized or formulaic or not varied enough, maybe not nuanced enough for them. And you still get such a broad range of flavors in the world of mezcal that I see a lot of exploration. Whereas in tequila, you might find your person that's really a devout Siete Leguas or Fortaleza or, you know, what have you, Cascaween. Or G4, that'll kind of be their go-to. But that's a good thing, I think, generally for mezcal. Oaxaca has traditionally been the single poorest, and most economically disenfranchised state, suffering the largest malnutrition and undereducated or unscholared populace, with all of the profound health and sociocultural effects that that has. It had once great forests, a lot of forestry, but that was depleted and not cared for. Big fisheries, which were depleted, not cared for. It doesn't really lend itself well to cattle or big crops because of that rough terrain. But Mezcal has really been a blessing. And there are now over 5,000 brands produced by over 2,000 different small operators. So
I've read that it's kept people from moving away. Like instead of the kids moving to Mexico City or Guadalajara, they've stayed now and wanted to create this family business within.
That's been really profound. I think that if I'm happy to have been able to bring over to tequila, or at least be a participant in the world of tequila, of focusing on producers behind the product, what I've been proud of to see in Oaxaca, that I've been able to be a participant in something that keeps communities more together. Because when I got involved in this, you know, NAFTA had just recently been signed, the North America Free Trade Agreement, and Monsanto and Simplot Corn was underselling Oaxacan's own corn in markets. And town after town, they weren't young men. They were in factories in Chicago or in tobacco fields in North Carolina or in lettuce fields in Tacoma, Washington, or, you know, Guadalajara, Jalisco, or Mexico City. And now I go down to our little town square and all these young men there, all their families, all their kids, their motorcycles and their horses and their trucks. And it's really, it just really hits me in the heart. It's really a wonderful, wonderful thing to see what Mezcal has also brought.
Yeah. And I think you need to play your part in that, knowing that you helped bring this to where it is today and really helped those regions. Because I don't know if it wasn't for people like you who've done what you have done, that it would be that way. So
others, you know, I'm, as Willie Shakespeare said, world is a stage and we're all just actors upon it, right? It's more a blessing for me to be able to do this in my life than it is for anyone else. That's surely true.
I also know that you're a very humble guy and that you wouldn't take any of that credit. So I'm going to lay that credit upon you and know that you've came a long way from delivering Mezcal to people's houses in 5-gallon gas cans and 2-gallon gas cans to really bringing something to
my brother Kwasi always remembers in Oakland when I was about a couple of years after Too Short was selling CDs out of his trunk along East 14th in Oakland, but right at when Master P and E40, those guys were selling cassettes out of their trunk. I was out there selling Mezcal door to door.
Delivering it in gas cans, literally. Right?
That was Oaxaca, but in Oakland.
Oh, you were doing that at home. I got you. Okay, so I have a question. I have a question about this one. So the Reposado that you have, I'm getting ready to pour. So are these the same barrels that the 1123 sit in?
Exactly. So
for those who don't know, tell that process a little bit.
Nothing like a pandemic to have one sitting in their apartment wondering what the hell am I going to do with myself with what I've already got and enough time to think about it. Raul Placencia, Don Raul Placencia from Espanol in the late 80s had told me that he loved Don Amado so much because it reminded him of the tequilas that his grandfather used to make. And so I thought, yeah, sure. You know, I didn't understand what he was talking about. And maybe 8-10 years later, someone sent me an old overly reproduced, kind of blurry copy of the old 1944, I think it was, Norma Oficial Mexicana of Tequila, which stipulated how one needed to make tequila in conformance with the Consejo Nacional de, or the Consejo Regulador de Tequila. And then in some bar conversation, I forget where, we were thinking, pondering, how the hell Oh, I remember when I was doing Centinela and Cabrito, the breakthrough, that was the first Highland distillery in Los Altos de Jalisco. And the Camarenas were the first real cultivators of agave up there. But that was all like in 1895, 1897, 1910, you know, which corresponds with the introduction of the internal combustion engine. And before then, you just didn't have Highland agave down to the distilleries. And there was no rail spur in Los Altos. Where this up it got was La Barca. And I just started thinking, well, how did you get make really, how would they have superlative, wonderful tequilas in like 1850 that weren't so herbaceous and dry and low bricks? You know, we're all become very attracted to kind of a high highland floral, bright flavor in tequila. And I thought, man, how interesting would it be to try to recreate a mid-19th century style of tequila? You'd have to use a kind of a family, small producer who sticks to old methodologies. Guillermo is too busy just trying to get out enough Fortaleza to the market. But the other family that came to my mind who does such a great job is the Rosales with Cascawin. And, you know, the United States has militarily invaded Mexico 7 times. So Mexico has never developed any kind of interest in American whiskey whatsoever. So there's never been a presence of American whiskey barrels outside of the modern era when multinational liquor behemoths own brands, different categories. So they own a bourbon, now they own a tequila distillery. So they move these bourbon barrels down to tequila. But those barrels, of course, contain char, which is, you know, carbon filtration, which removes all the nuance of your tequila. But what were the old barrels that were used? Were, of course, brandy barrels, like we talked about earlier, from the Spanish and from the French. And that just happens to be what I've been buying since 1996 from Don Amado. Since 1996. I just realized that's 30 years.
Oh.
But, and then when I hear from Don Raul Plasencia that the way they used to make tequila was kind of like where we make mezcal today, like fermenting with the fiber.
Mm-hmm.
I put it together and I went down and talked to Don Salvador, Chava's dad,
mm-hmm.
and Chava, of course, and said, you guys, let me send you my old mezcal barrels, my well-exhausted and cured mezcal barrels that were formerly Pedro Domecq brandy barrels.
Mm-hmm.
And use agave from your environs here, Valley Floor agave, which is only, you know, 22 bricks, nothing like the 27, 28 to 30 bricks that we get up in the Highlands. That's, sorry, I go on and on with it, but that's the 11, 23. And then, you'll see in that it's a Blanco, but it's got like 20, 22, 25 days of mm-hmm. aging. I'm supposed to call it conditioning.
Resting.
And it used to, you know, in the 19th century. And then because you are softening it with that conditioning, you could kick up the proof a little bit. So whereas tequila is typically 38%, you could get away with 43%. So the CRT wouldn't let me call it a Blanco Histórico, but I wanted to call it a Blanco Histórico, a historic Blanco. They said you'll have to use that in your marketing link, you know, but there's no like category of a Blanco Histórico, but you can market it as that. Then Felipe Camarena said to me, Garrón, ¿qué estás haciendo? You know, he's got a masterful way with his words. I was about to say another bunch of expletives, but I won't. What's going on? He said, you're doing another Blanco Arteno Blanco. And I said, no, Felipe, that's a Blanco Histórico. You're a Blanco, and I thought of it really quickly, Clásico, transparent. And he said, okay. Got some D. Let's go get some lunch. But I'll never forget just how simultaneously something, a unique feeling, you know, we say in our English, we don't have enough words. The Germans like have 3 times the amount of words we do. So there's a different word for each kind of happiness or something, you know, each kind of love. But whatever the word would be that I felt so many times with Mexicans in Mexico, simultaneous relief and happiness, and also kind of impressed and awe that I'm learning a different way. Everything doesn't have to be so goddamn competitive. And, you know, it's not a zero-sum game, as we're always trying to explain, like, regarding immigration, you know, in the United States. It's not that someone's going to take your job. There's enough for everybody to have a job. And that idea that's fundamental in Mexico of, you know, I para todos, I mezcal, I este pastel para todos.
It's one thing I love about this industry, the tequila world, is, you know, outside of maybe a little hate for the giants, right, the big behemoths, outside of a little hate for those people, is the
actually that hate is more prevalent among the enthusiasts, not among the makers.
I can see that.
Almost all of the makers that I've had, the producers I've gotten to know, have long, complicated, intertwined relationships with some of the giants.
Yeah, I guess it's how I see the little brands pick up and promote another little brand. Like, I never see a little brand go, oh, well, you should just drink, you know, that big brand. But they're always like, but that over there, that's my buddy's brand. You should try that one too. Like, if you're going to explore tequila, please check out this guy's brand and this guy's brand, and this master distiller is praising this master distiller. And, you know, to sit in a room and hear Eliana Partida talk about Jimmy Sousa and you know, Sergio talk about Oscar. Like, it's all like this giant family. And then you're like, well, wait a minute. This is like Walmart telling people to go to Kmart. Like, it's completely different, you know, in the way that it's treated. Yeah. And I love
it. Well, as you said early on in this conversation, the boutique tequilas or the homemade tequilas are growing around 25-30%.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of the sentiment of prosperity right now.
Yeah. Yep.
I lamentably, we don't see that kind of vibe in mezcal. No, not too much.
So going back to this one. So once these barrels have the Artenom 1123, then they go back, right? And then the mezcal goes back in those barrels. So what I'm getting here is maybe a little transference of the 1123 before back and forth.
And I really enjoyed now bringing a bottle of Don Amado Repo to 1123 Artenom tastings.
Well, I'm going to do that in the next tasting I do, because this is
so freaking
good. It's fire.
There's a great expression in Spanish, Mexico, like we can say, no hay panadero que habla mal de su pan, which means there's no baker that speaks ill of his bread. So I want to, you say, this is really good. My instinct is to say, isn't it though? Right?
But it is. I know that it is so good.
There's no baker that's going to speak ill of his bread. But I just think that, I mean, it's the cat's meow, as they say, you know?
It is. I mean, I just poured it. Like, this is my first time ever tasting it. And I'm like, this is what I would say in my good old Midwestern vernacular. Dude, this is stupid. It's so good. This is amazing.
Give me a boxer. Now, this is wicked, bro.
Do you ever hit on one of my...
Yeah, we do an añejo, but the añejo is not historically congruent. We do an añejo because my partner and I, my business partner and I, just love it. So we do an añejo, but it's mostly for ourselves.
I was going to say, añejo is not a normal
one
thing.
One of my big loving meditation laments in mezcal was that who had the money and the maturity, the age, and the financial resources to really bring and develop mezcal in the United States was also someone who barely could order their dinner in Spanish and circulated with Kind of cynical, I would say. Old industry guys in the liquor business who, in my mind, had a serious misread on what had happened between Siete Leguas and Patron. And there was an era of real cynicism, like attraction to maybe the economic possibilities, but a cynicism of the process. You know, not an application of good process to get to a good end, but more an ends-oriented vision, and then let's cobble together whatever fucking process we knowingly or very unknowingly want to put together. And with that cynicism came a worry that people would jack up the price if they saw that the product was going to hit. They would steal, that you didn't want to be beholden to any inventory, kind of cash on the barrel head, or on this cash on the receptacle head, because there's no barrel. And so a total leaving behind of that third type of mezcal that I grew up knowing about called refinado. Somebody yesterday was talking about Rolando and Assis from the old Jogorio. Those guys, their last name is gifted for them. But they're the Jogorio family, their mother, well, they're cousins, but Rolando's mom had three barrels, I remember, in the late 80s. You know, for their like commemorative mezcal, commemorativo. It was very much part of what was around as really good mezcal. I mean, not everybody had old barrels, but if a family had somehow acquired one or two, three barrels, they used them. And it was part of it. And, you know, 10 years after I was off on this adventure, I was reprimanded so from New York to LA, you know, from Miami to Seattle, about what mezcal should be.
Yeah.
You should never age mezcal. And I was like, why the hell not?
Yes, you should.
Yeah, why the hell shouldn't you? You shouldn't age it in, you know, carbon-laden bourbon barrels or...
Right.
Or overage it, but soft conditioning mezcal with a little bit of wood is not a problem. It's also not necessary, but it's not a problem. We make a brand called Los Perdidos for some really great guys. And they sent us all the way from France a Calvados barrel, a cognac barrel, and an Armagnac barrel. And they wanted us, and we did, barrel aged Tepestate and Arroqueño.
Okay.
And I said, you know, these are 18 and 23 year agave. Like, hey, we're not going to go over 3 or 4 months. And they said, no, that's all we want. And I'll be damned if those aren't clay pod distilled, 18 and 23 year old agave species in an Armagnac barrel for 4 months. Best of show in the San Francisco Spirits Competition. Best of show, best artisanal mezcal, 97 points, both of them. I mean, we work, you know, tastings and trade shows everywhere, and there's just a throng of people at the table. So, you know,
I have to say, as a Blanco drinker normally, right, I'm not a big aged spirits person. I always say for me, the aged spirit that I go to pour is usually the last drink of the night. It's If I've drank all day or drank all evening, I've had high proof Blanco or Blanco, and then I'm getting ready to go to bed. That's when I pour my, I call it my dessert drink, right? I go pour my repo that I like, or extra añejo. And mezcal to me is always never been aged. I've always just gone, you know, this is the first aged mezcal. I take that back. The second, Juan Pina has a brand called Projilo. Is that how you say that? This brand right here. You ever What's heard of called? This one? Projilo.
Oh, yeah.
He had we were at an agave festival. He said these people took all this mezcal. They told him that the mezcal was junk. They threw it in barrels, and it sat in these barrels for like 12 years, and they were going to dump it. Yikes. And he said, can we taste it? And they're like, yeah. And it was phenomenal. So he bought all the barrels and he bottled it. So it's a 12-year-old mezcal.
Wow.
And I'm like, very skeptical, you know, and we're at this trade show and he poured it for a bunch of us, and we all tasted it. We all looked at each other and we're like, holy crap, like, what is this? Like, it was so delicious. So he bottled it and sold it out like immediately. And, you know, people are like, so much hate for having an aged mezcal.
Spirits are so fun like that. I mean, obviously, not everything's for everybody, you know. People, when I drink scotch, it's Lafroig. I love the flavor, you know.
Oh, you and my daughter.
couple weeks ago, someone shared some Springbank 15-year-old with me, and
yeah,
that has a lot softer smoke, but so much complexity. So you just can't dismiss aged spirits. I mean,
you have to give him a shot.
Why? You know?
Well, dude, it's a Friday night.
That doesn't detract from loving all of these varietals.
Absolutely. I think that's the coolest part.
Thank you, Brad. It's always such a great time with you.
No, I appreciate you taking your time away from your family to sit and talk with me on the internet. I love it. And I can't wait to meet you in person. We got to make this happen. You're always so accommodating to us when we're in Tequila and in Mexico. And I just really, truly appreciate you more than what you know. So thank you so much.
It's mutual, brother. Totally mutual. Appreciate you. Salud. Hope you have a great weekend.